The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here. Today
FM. Marion McKeown, US correspondent of the Business Post, is with us. But first, Cal Thomas, nationally syndicated US columnist. Should we be issuing a parental advisory for our item tonight, given the rather sleazy nature of much of the evidence given by the adult entertainment star Stormy Daniels in the Donald Trump trial in New York in the last few hours?
Yeah, I think we should, Matt. Even the judge has admonished one of the prosecuting attorneys not to get into such detail. But what we know so far, and parental warning, Stormy Daniels claims that she was in Trump Tower with Trump and spanked him with a magazine that had his picture on the cover. Now, that to me is, that just made me laugh like crazy. And then, according to her, she said to Trump, "What about your wife?" And he is alleged to have said, "Don't worry about her. We sleep in another room anyway." I don't think you would want him as an advisor on how to maintain a strong marriage, would you?
Which isn't the issue, in fairness, though, that is to be decided by the jury.
Well, let me just quote something that Jonathan Turley, the eminent law professor at George Washington University, just posted on X. He said it's not clear what Daniels offers besides salacious details to embarrass Trump. The NDA is not in dispute. Her testimony will not materially impact the evidence on whether reimbursement to Michael Cohen was correctly denoted on records. Now, he says, and it's very funny, ironically, even a porn star who sought to cash in on a scandal may be more credible than the serial perjurer disbarred Michael Cohen. I can't wait for him to get on the stand and see him raise his hand and promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And the defense counsel is likely to say, "Why should we believe you now, Mr. Cohen, when you've been described by a judge as a serial perjurer?"
We'll get to Michael Cohen in time, but let's stick with Stormy Daniels. So, Marion McKeown, as well as being a journalist, you're a qualified lawyer. Is this all really necessary, this sort of testimony about the sexual contact alleged between the couple, to the case at hand?
Well, no, I don't think it is, actually. But I think the reason that they're doing this, and I do understand this, is that Trump has always denied vehemently that he ever had anything to do with Stormy Daniels, that he knew her, that he met her. He said on the campaign trail, I remember back in 2016, actually, that he was going to sue every single one of the women, including Stormy Daniels, for defamation as soon as, you know, basically the election campaign was over. He has denigrated her and called her a liar and said a number of really ugly things about her in public. So I think that if you could argue that the prosecution, in order to make their case, want the jury to say, okay, here's Stormy Daniels' version of events and here's Donald Trump's. Now, who do you believe? Now, if you believe Stormy Daniels' version of events, then it makes sense that money was paid to her, hush money was paid, and it makes sense that Donald Trump tried to cover it up before the election campaign, and it makes, or before the election, I beg your pardon, especially after the Access Hollywood tape. But if he never met her, as he claims, or had nothing to do with her, then none of this would actually make sense. But there isn't any need, I think, for the sort of details that did come out, unless, you know, the prosecution do believe that the details go to her credibility. And will Donald Trump, if he takes the stand, be asked to refute every one of those details? And as Cal said, some of them are pretty tawdry, but some of them are also really nasty. Like, for example, that he told her before he had sex with her that this is the only way you're going to get out of the trailer park. You know, I'll bet his daughter Ivanka isn't too thrilled. And we did hear this before several times, that he told Stormy Daniels she reminded him of his daughter. It's the whole thing really does portray Trump as a very grubby, tawdry individual. But that in itself is not a crime. The crime is that this is the payoff was so that he could win the election. That's the alleged crime, I should say, that this money and the concealment of it and everything else was all to disguise the fact that it was, in fact, a campaign finance benefit and that it was to influence the outcome of the election.
I wonder, Cal, how all of these revelations are going to go down with voters.
Well, when Marion mentioned the trailer park line, it reminded me of something James Carville, a top advisor to Bill Clinton, once said, that you never know what you're going to get when you drag a dollar through a trailer park. So this is just irrelevant to a lot of voters. I think in the United States, and I don't know how it is in Ireland now, but the level of expectation for upright politicians is now so low that you can do things like Donald Trump is alleged to have done, and people just don't care anymore. They don't expect anything better, and that's really a sad state of affairs. I mean, character and integrity at least used to be something that people gave lip service to, and a lot of them practiced and still do. But now when you have one man who's running for re-election and who has clearly got cognitive issues, and you've got the other man who's got clear moral issues, what a choice. I mean, I think we can do better, as John F. Kennedy said in 1960.
Maybe your man Trump has cognitive issues as well. That's what a lot of people think. If you listen to a lot of the speeches that he's giving, as the mistakes that he continuously makes and identifying people and even being coherent in his presentations, you'd wonder about that as well, Cal.
Well, same could be said of Kristi Noem. I don't know if you're going to get to her on this segment or not.
Again, but she hasn't shot another dog, has she?
Not yet. But yeah, there was one joke on the Babylon Bee that says she went to the Kentucky Derby looking for horses to shoot. That was very funny. I think that was one of the dumbest political mistakes I've ever seen in my life. You got 62 million Americans who own dogs. Some of them love their dogs more than their own kids. I mean, this is not the way to win an election. She's toast if she ever was a white bread for Trump's running mate, not only based on this, but this book she's got coming out where she claims to have met Kim Jong-un. I know you have, but I certainly don't believe she has.
No. I've never claimed to having met Kim Jong-un. I was in the same room, but I was stopped from meeting him. I don't make false claims, Cal.
That's right. You went over with the basketball team. That's right. But you were in the same room. That's almost as good.
Well, what is this issue? Well, actually, we'll move off Trump for a little while. We will be back to him. But Marion McKeown, this one, Kristi Noem. We spoke about her last Tuesday on the programme. I thought she would have been completely finished by now on the back of the revelations. Is she still a talking point in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, this story, people just are so, I have to say, almost lethal about this story because it's so barking mad, and no pun intended there, but also
utterly intended, Marion.
Then she got, no, completely unintended, I assure you. Then she comes up with this Kim Jong-un thing, and she says that he may have underestimated me, but I'm used to, you know, staring down little tyrants. Now, that is a line that was apparently in the original copy of the book, and apparently it's since been taken out. So she never met Kim Jong-il. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But then her press people are saying, oh, that was put in by mistake, and, you know, it was in the list of world leaders that she has met, and we've taken it out since. But she was the one who claimed that she basically stared him down because she's used to dealing with little tyrants. So again, this is just fantasy. She won't address it properly. There was quite a surreal moment on, was it Meet the Press I saw on Sunday, where she was asked by Margaret Brennan, she was talking about Commander Joe Biden's dog and saying that he should have been put down. And at one point, I think it was Margaret Brennan, said to her, so do you think he should be shot? And I thought for a moment she was talking about the president, about President Biden, that she wasn't in fact talking about the dog. The whole thing is sort of, it's kind of nuts, and it's almost, because this campaign, I think, is so grim and there's so much unpleasantness, I think people are almost jumping on Kristi Noem as light relief. Now, I think, you know, you would have to assume her chances of becoming vice president are over, but she was at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump, with another six or seven people who are all said to be in the running for vice president still. At the weekend, she was still invited and she was still there. And Donald Trump doesn't like dogs, so maybe he doesn't see this as any big deal. Who knows?
Yeah, Cal, the others who were there, who now apparently are in the running to be the vice presidential picks. Marco Rubio, who, if I remember correctly, back in 2016, Trump absolutely roasted during the debates for the Republican nomination. Tim Scott of South Carolina, Elise Stefanik, Byron Daniels, the aforementioned Kristi Noem, and one who actually really interests me because I actually really enjoyed his book, Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance, now the senator for Ohio. Cal?
Yeah, a lot of these people, yes, a lot of these people called Trump all sorts of names when they were running against him. Now, all of a sudden, including J.D. Vance and Tim Scott, are all bowing at the knee, trying to kiss his ring, if not his backside. It's just the most amazing thing. This is what has caused me to lead off my line on the lecture circuit. I'm happy to be here tonight from Washington, D.C., where the only politicians with convictions are in prison. Ba-dum-boom.
Right. Okay, which one of those six is going to get the VP nod?
It's hard to say. I mean, I like Tim Scott a lot. I've met him on a couple of occasions. He's very smart. He's been a really good senator. He builds good personal relationships. But I don't know. There's so many other factors involved, and we don't know how all these trials are going to come out and whether they're going to be appeals. Well, there will be appeals if he's convicted, obviously. But I don't particularly have a favorite at the moment. I've just learned not to trust any of these people to live up to what they say 100%. Because I've been around Washington a long time, and there are very few who have done that.
Okay, who do you think, Marion, is it likely to be?
Well, I really hope it isn't Tim Scott. He was interviewed on Sunday as well, and he refused to say that he would accept the results of the election, regardless of who won. Now, that to me is just shocking, that you have somebody who's in the running to be a vice president, who's prepared to say that he won't necessarily accept the results of a Democratic election, even before it happens. So I think that was disgraceful. I think that should disqualify him immediately. Unfortunately, it'll just make him probably more likely to get it. There seems to be a lot of, I would say, momentum around J.D. Vance. I think he'd be a dreadful choice. I think he's a pretty obnoxious human being. He doesn't come across as likable in any way. He's more MAGA than MAGA. I don't see what he would bring to the table. What Trump needs to do is to broaden his appeal. And I really don't see how he would do that. The same goes for Marco Rubio. He's Florida. What does he bring to the table? I don't know. I don't think any of them are inspiring choices at all. I think the one person who would actually be a really smart choice would be Nikki Haley, if she would take the job and if Trump would offer it to her, because she would bring the moderates back to the table, and he really needs them.
Okay, we have lots more to talk about with both Marion McKeown and Cal Thomas when we come back after this break. Marion McKeown and Cal Thomas have stayed with us, and Marion, we've spoken a number of times about the failure of the Americans to force Israel into a ceasefire in Gaza, and Joe Biden's claims that a ceasefire was near being so well off the mark. So what happens now, given that, again, it seems that Hamas was prepared to cut a deal for ceasefire, and instead the Israelis are pressing on into Rafah, pressing on to that part of Gaza where, if you remember rightly, a few months ago, it told the Palestinians to go because that's where they would be safe?
Yeah, I just based on a briefing that we had with the National Security Council, it seems that the ceasefire is still ongoing. Talks are the talks about the ceasefire are still ongoing. That it seems that Hamas has indicated that it can proceed with the ceasefire, that has accepted the wording changes. Bill Burns, the CIA director, who's been really in the Middle East doing almost nothing else for months now other than trying to get this ceasefire, you know, off the ground, is back there again. Israel is talking about a sustainable calm. Now, a sustainable calm is a really hard thing to define. That doesn't mean a ceasefire. Does it mean they would just target operations in one area and the rest of it, Gaza would be calm? We don't know. So I think that what's being offered at the moment, it seems, and I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks back, it's the same thing pretty much, that Israel wants the return of 33 hostages, and that there would be a 42-day, that's 6-week ceasefire, and that there will be three different phases to this. Now, as I say, that there's nothing in that in a way that would preclude Israel from targeted operations in Rafah. But the problem is, will these operations be targeted, and how can you target operations in an area that is so densely packed? You've got over 1 million internally displaced people who are there, and on top of the more than 250,000 people who already live there, conditions are dire, but at least humanitarian aid can reach them there. Now, we know that Israel has now taken over the area inside the Rafah crossing, and that at the moment there's no aid getting in. So everything seems to be still in a very chaotic, uncertain situation, and nobody really seems to know what's happening for sure. I suspect over the next next couple of days, it will become clearer.
Okay, but Cal, there is a big political issue for President Joe Biden here, and I'm not asking you to restate your defence of Israel, as you've done many times on this programme in the past, but I am interested in what you think will happen politically if the Biden administration notifies Congress that Israel has violated international laws in Gaza. I mean, what would actually happen on the back of that? Could America continue to supply weapons to Israel when it realises, or when it makes a finding, a determination, that it has actually been breaking international law with the way it's been behaving in Gaza?
You will notice, Matt, that they never talk about the terrorist groups violating international law when they murder, rape, kidnap people, holding them as hostages. This is like playing a card game where one side plays by the rules and the other side has no rules at all. I have a column coming in on this on Thursday in my newspapers, and one of the analogies I use, imagine, I say, if someone had said to Franklin Roosevelt near the end of World War II, don't take Berlin, we can negotiate with Adolf Hitler. And he reconstitutes the National Socialist Party and goes on to kill Jews, which he was doing very effectively to the tune of 6 million, as we know and remember, on Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was yesterday. So I think there's a double standard here, and the Hamas is not going to give up. They're going to reconstitute if they're allowed to live. Yes, it's densely populated in Rafah, but as we've said before, I've said before, this is part of Hamas's deal. They hide out among civilians, hoping that Israel will come after them, kill civilians in the meantime, and then they can call CNN and the other networks and show film. This has been going on for decades. It's the same old scenario. It never changes.
If they are allowed to live, are you suggesting that Israel is justified in mass murder?
Mass murder? What about those people on October 7th, those innocent Israelis and babies?
It was a disgrace. It was dreadful. It was an appalling act. Yeah. It was wrong.
But
everywhere, condemn it. But 30,000 people have died as part of the Israeli response, a small number of whom were actually Hamas terrorists. Are you denying that that Israel have been killing people?
You're using figures from Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Those are clearly inflated. They've been inflated in the past. They're done for media consumption in this country and for certain liberal groups who want to put pressure on. Now, you asked earlier about Biden. I think what he is doing, he was very clear after the October 7 attack in his support of Israel and his support for what they were doing to exterminate Hamas. But since then, he's taking a look at Michigan and Minnesota, where there are considerable number of Muslim voters, and a lot of commentators say, and I agree with them, that he is trying to appeal to them. But I don't think that's going to work, because you're already seeing demonstrations among these communities that are opposed to Biden. Now, whether they're going to vote for Trump or not is another question. I think a lot of them might just stay home. But I think this is a cynical ploy to get more of the Muslim vote, and it's really too bad.
Marion McKeown, could it be the real issue here is that for all of the efforts that have been made for diplomacy by the American and by the Biden administration, Netanyahu is simply out of control? And I know Cal disputes the numbers, but internationally I think it's accepted that we've had at least 30,000 deaths as a result of the Israeli invasion, and we have seen the evidence of the mass destruction of a country as part of a campaign that many people feel is, and this is incredible to say, given what the Jewish people suffered during the Holocaust, is now by Israel a genocidal campaign.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's interesting. Israel hasn't denied the figures, which are now around 34,000. Israel has never come out and said that many people hasn't been killed. Hamas is lying. I think that figure is widely accepted. And I think if you look at the absolute destruction of Gaza, if you look at the aerial photos, if you look at the film that's been coming out of Gaza, you cannot but assume that there must be a catastrophic death toll. And of course, let's not forget about the people who are dying of starvation, the people who are dying as a result of this rapid onset situation, an entirely man-made famine. Now, I think Joe Biden is in an impossible position. position. He's got to basically come up, in the next couple of days and decide whether or not he believes that Israel is in violation of humanitarian law. We have this national security memorandum, which we spoke about a while ago, that Chris Van Hollen and a bunch of Democrats forced Biden into basically in February because they said he was ignoring the humanitarian crisis. And so he took that as a pact, and it said any country receiving U.S. military aid has to provide written assurances that they're abiding by international law and that they're allowing humanitarian aid in. Now, it's clear that Israel is certainly not doing that at the moment. If you look at the way humanitarian aid has been blocked, even ignore the strike on the central kitchen staff, ignore the other stories that have been coming out about the harassment and the targeting of aid workers. But then there's also the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act, and that also says similar things. So Joe Biden, I think he cannot say Israel is in compliance with the memorandum and with the Foreign Assistance Act. And if he doesn't say it, then he's going to enrage a huge number of people as well. It's a dreadful position. But all Benjamin Netanyahu wants, and I think people agree, is to stay in power. And I think that he doesn't care what he has to do to achieve that end. And unfortunately, the suffering that we're seeing as a result is horrific.
Marion McKeown and Cal Thomas, thank you as ever for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.